Okay, I have the approval. So thank you for giving me the honor of starting this conference. I'm in the very interesting situation of being both a local participant and jet-lagged. So please forgive me if I'm a bit slow. The title of my talk is Boundary Conditions for Free Fields. And what this is based on is a work that appeared a few months back that I did in collaboration with Eduardo Lauria, Davide Gaiotto, and Davide's student, Jing Shang. And also some developments, which are very much in progress and preliminary, but in the spirit of informalness, I will also talk about those, that I'm doing also together with Connor Behan and Baltman Rees. Okay, so my talk is gonna be in the broad subject of non-local conformal theories. So let me say just a few words why I think these objects are interesting. So this means that we are studying conformal correlators in theories which don't have a stress tensor. And I like these objects because they have a few nice angles. So of course, as my title says, these are important when we study boundaries and defects in CFT. And they also have applications to the real world, or maybe I should say to phase transitions, applications to phase transitions. If we start with some lattice with long-range interactions, the main example that many of you are for sure familiar with is the long-range easing. And they're also nice because they correspond to the boundary of generic quantum field theories on ADS background. And so a lot of phenomena that we like for massive quantum field theories, when we put them in NDS, they get mapped to, or they should be visible at the level of the non-local conformal theories that lives on their boundary. Like, of course, a prominent example of this is the use of conformal theories to constrain scattering matrices of field theories, which I'm sure we're gonna hear about more in this conference. So my talk is gonna be in this angle. Is it working? Can you hear me? Okay, unless there are problems, I will continue. So yeah, in this like huge space of non-local theories, I will concentrate on a very special corner, which is sort of a natural question that one can ask. What can we say about the space of boundary conditions and perhaps also defects if we make the huge restriction that we want to consider free field theories in the bulk? So let me explain why I think this is an interesting restriction to consider. So there is a very nice motivating example that actually is the reason why I'm considering this problem to start with, which is the case of a free Maxwell field in bulk four dimensions. And this basically was the subject of my paper with Eduardo. And I will spend some time in my talk reviewing this example and the properties of this special case. So I think maybe some of you at this point are thinking that this is too difficult, and some of you are thinking that it is too hard. So let me explain why it's a bit in between.
Too difficult or too
easy, yes. Sorry, jet lagged. So I can use, so one thing why, one reason why this is, of course, one thing that we can use to simplify this problem is that we have bulk equation of motion. And these equations of motion give us infinitely many constraints on the boundary data. If I go to low and you cannot see anymore, tell me. And of course I will explain how this works. But still we expect, even though we have somehow constrained setup, we still expect a very rich space of possibilities. Rich space of possibilities. For instance, in this nice example that I mentioned, the space of boundary conditions includes 3D CFTs with global E1 symmetry, as I will review. So it seems like we are a bit between something easy and something hard, and so we should try to study it. So let me explain a little bit better what is the problem. So we consider we put a boundary in RD. So I'll call the coordinate here y and here x if needed, when y is bigger than 0. And we can consider fields propagating in this space which obey free equations of motion, so for instance a free scalar, or we could have a free fermion, or like in 4D, I can have the case of Maxwell. This of course can be generalized to, if one really wants, one can also consider p-forms in plus 2 dimensions with a gauge symmetry, but okay, I will restrict to this case. And now, this, in general, in boundary conformal field theories, we have the bulk to boundary OPE that tells us what happens when we push an operator close to the boundary. We'll find a certain number of operators living on the boundary. Now, we can use this constraint to hugely simplify the back-to-boundary OPEs in these cases. So for instance, one finds that in this case, the only possibilities are, I will denote with hats boundary operators. So one can only have two possible boundary primaries, and the dots denote descendants. And similarly for the other cases, like if I have the bulk free Dirac, when I go close to the boundary, this can be decomposed in a way compatible with the reduced symmetry of the problem. Two modes, and of course there are descendants, where these modes are defined by the property that I decompose in blocks using the gamma matrix in the y direction. And similarly for the Maxwell field, what we find is that we can have so conserved currents on the boundary. And the reason for this normalization, at the moment it's a bit mysterious, but it will become clear later. So yeah, in all these cases, what one finds is that the most general back-to-boundary OP compatible with equations contain only two boundary primaries. And then the situation that maybe we are more familiar with is the one in which we impose that one of these two guys, one of these two modes that we have at the boundary, is set to zero. So it's like, this is a special. So there is a special set of boundary conditions. And this is the case in which that I will call free boundary conditions. So these are free boundary conditions for free fields in which one of these primaries is set to zero. And in this case, the set of correlators on the boundary is very simple. So the boundary conformal theory is just given by mean field theory of the surviving operator. Please stop me if you have questions at any time. So yeah, for instance, the usual Neumann boundary condition for the field will be that I impose that this operator is zero, and then I just get mean field theory for the operator phi, and similarly for all the other cases. But then this is just like the tip of the iceberg, because what we expect is that there is a full trivial set of boundary conditions, which I will call interacting boundary conditions for the free field, in which both operators are present in the spectrum. And in this case, the theory is not, the theory on the boundary will not be just mean field theory. And we will have some interacting conformal theory on the boundary. Let me give some, so this may seem a bit abstract, so what are some simple examples? So, for instance, for a free scalar, we can start with just this field living in here. And there is a boundary. And for instance, let's imagine that we start with Neumann boundary conditions. So this operator is trivial. But what we can do is that we can add some decoupled local CFT in d minus one dimensions living there, and we can turn on some interactions that involve the boundary value of the field and some operator of this local sector. So for instance, a simple example, I can add a free fermion living on the boundary And then I can add boundary interaction that mixes boundary value of the scalar field and so some mixed Yukawa, sometimes called in the literature. There was a recent paper by Herzog that considers this example. And so if you do this, you're gonna start an RG flow. So the dimension of this coupling G is 4 minus D over 2, if we have like D bulk dimensions. And for instance, in epsilon expansion, so taking D equal 4 minus epsilon, one can reliably see that this RG flow admits a fixed point. And the correlators on the boundary are going to be not just those of open field theory. There is going to be some non-trivial spectrum of operators, of peak coefficients, etc. And in what sense I can see this case as the one in which both operators are turned on, as I defined before the interacting boundary conditions. So this is just because when I turn on this interaction and I look at the, making the action stationary in presence of the boundary, I will find that the operator D of I hat that previously was set to 0 gets deformed to be just the bilinear in the fermions. And in general, of course, this is just an example. One can consider whatever local CFT in lower dimension with the operators which are sufficiently low dimensional that allow me to turn on some relevant interaction. And in the generic case, we expect this to flow to some interacting boundary condition. I don't know of a way to prove that they flow to an interacting boundary condition. Like in this case, we can reliably see that this happens in epsilon expansion. But in general, it's just, if you wish, a conjecture. Now I want to spend some time talking about another example, which is what I call like the motivating example for this. Which is the case of the Maxwell field. So this was example one. So let's consider U1 gauge field in 4D. Apologize, probably many of you already heard this talk in some version, but I will try to make it a bit different than when I gave it previously. So, we consider an action. I mean, I will use a notation which is nice for the point of view of SL2Z, electromagnetic duality. So consider this action, which is just a free action with tau being the complexified gauge coupling. For the gauge field, and then this F plus and minus are just the usual self-dual, anti-self-dual components. And so we can define these two currents, which are basically the same that I wrote there, but in a fancier notation. And so these are basically the electric and magnetic currents of the theory on the boundary. And okay, so I just wanted to leave this so that you can see that it's the same, and this explains these strange normalizations. And so
the two perhaps more familiar boundary conditions, which are in the class of free boundary conditions in the sense that we discussed before, are the Neumann boundary condition, in which we set this guy to zero, or Dirichlet boundary condition, in which we set this magnetic current to zero, and they are exchanged by electromagnetic duality. Pedro, you're gonna give me some warning on time. So how am I doing now?
You have 20 minutes.
Okay, good. So if I consider more general, these two guys are just exchanged. These two boundary conditions are exchanged by electromagnetic duality. And I can consider also more general SL2Z transformation. So this SL2Z is the full group of duality of this theory if I don't have any boundary. And this acts on the complexified gauge coupling as follows. And it also rotates these currents just as a vector. So this is, of course, just a special case in which we take the S transformation. So you can see that starting with these free boundary conditions, if we act with this SL2Z action, we are going to generate an even more general set of free boundary conditions, which are the following. So these are like the general, so these two are integers. These are like the general free boundary condition for this theory. And now let's go away from the free boundary condition by turning on some perturbation. Yes? Yeah, so what we said before is that when we set something to zero, like we have always like two modes, right? We set one to zero, and what we get on the boundary is the mean field theory of the other guy, right? So in this case, for instance, we set this to zero, we get the mean field theory of I, and vice versa. When you set this to zero, you're going to get the mean field theory of the orthogonal linear combination, which is something like... So this is the operator where P prime U minus p q prime is equal to zero, I guess. Yes. Okay. Now, so how can we introduce something interesting in the boundary in this case? So let's consider the case in which we place some local CFT3 on the boundary with U1 global symmetry. And still we have this U1 gauge field that lives here. And the natural thing that we can do is that we can couple them by adding this interaction term between the current and the restriction to the boundary of the gauge field. I'm not sure where should I put the hats. So if you do that, I should specify that I start with Neumann boundary conditions. So I start with a Neumann boundary condition in which this J is set to zero and the gauge field is free to fluctuate on the boundary. I add a CFT3 with U1 global symmetry, and then I couple the two in this way. If I do that, I get, similarly to this case that we discussed for the scalar, I will get a so-called modified Neumann condition, in which now, instead of J being zero, J is going to be identified with
the current of the CFD. And, and therefore now both I and J are non-trivial and the theory is not just mean-field theory. Now, what are the nice features of this example? Yes?
Wow. Just before you raise the free example before the boson, are there other operators? How do you know this is a one-parameter flow in general? Like phi cube, for instance, it would be marginal in 4D.
You mean if you are just some functional, some polynomial of the monomial of the van der Waal of the gauge of the scalar field?
Can you just stop there, or should you add all the terms that that are marginal or marginally relevant when you go to 4 minus t? I mean, relevant term you can tune, but like phi cube seem to be marginal in 4D. Is it relevant then when you go down?
Phi cube is marginal. So you're saying that in order to really be sure that there is a fixed point, we should also add that. That's true. I mean, you can get rid of it using some Z2 symmetry.
But phi, you're already breaking that now.
No, because it just gets mixed with the parity on the boundary. Parity flips chi bar chi.
Okay, thanks.
So you can get rid of it in that way. Yeah. So what are some nice features of this construction? So the notable property is that the parameter tau here is actually exactly marginal, meaning that the beta function is exactly zero. And this, together with the fact that we have this SL2Z that allows us to change frames in the bulk, so SL2Z, entails the existence of multiple decoupling limits. Where I mean the couplings between the bulk and the boundary, besides the obvious one, which is when we send tau to I infinity. So sending tau to I infinity just means that we send the gauge coupling to zero. And in that case, so we started the construction by coupling the gauge field to the current, and if we send the gauge coupling to zero, we just decouple the two. But now, the fact that we have SL2Z means that we can change frame in the bulk. And in all these frames, we can consider some dual tau prime going to I infinity. And also in that frame, we expect that the bulk and the boundary should decouple. And these multiple decoupling limits have, with, in general, different local CFTs with U1 symmetry. So in every decoupling limit, we will find that there is some CFT3 with U1 global symmetry that gets decoupled from the bulk. But in general, they will be different depending on which frame we choose to go to the decoupling limit. So I should say a few words to explain why tau is exactly marginal. But basically, this is just because, okay, before I erase it. So tau is basically the coefficient of a bulk operator. That's like the natural normalization to use. And we are only turning on an interaction which lives on the boundary. And it is a general fact that if you have just interactions on the boundary, they're not going to renormalize bulk operators. So just by locality. So if you want, it's very simple. And of course, you can also do loop calculations ordered by ordering 1 over tau and see that the beta function is zero and get surprised
but there is also a simple reason. So so what we get from this is that there is actually a continuous family of boundary of boundary conformal data. Continuous family. And there are some caveats that go into that. There are some possible obstructions to actually define this for possible taus, and I will discuss them presently. And okay, so I actually already said that, but BCFTs, and the property is that when tau goes to I infinity, I find the original CFT3. Let me say what is that we find at the other points. So if we have now some tau prime, and some S, which is obtained by some SF2Z rotation, the CFT that we're going to find is SL2Z transformation of the original CFT3. What does that mean? So Witten, a long time ago, described an SL2Z action on three-dimensional conformal field theories with the IU1 symmetry. So let me describe how that works. So we have the S transformation. So I can just define what is S and T, and this is going to define the full SL2Z. So the S transformation on the CFT. So this is a transformation that maps a CFT with the U1 global symmetry to another CFT with U1 global symmetry. This corresponds to gauging the U1 global symmetry with a 3D abelian gauge field. So not to be confused with the boundary value of the four-dimensional gauge field. It's really a 3D field, dynamical, that gauges this U1. And the new U1 I should say here, this is a construction by Witten. The new U1 is just the current associated to the new U1, is just the field strength, the dual of the field strength of this three-dimensional gauge field. And then there is the T transformation. The T transformation is pretty simple. The T transformation just corresponds to a shift by one unit of the contact term. In the two-point function of the current. So here we are like doing something really modifying the theory a lot. Well, the T transformation just do something very mild, which is to shift a contact term. They're not really changing the theory, the two-point function of the current. But remember that in three dimensions, term is not visible. In three dimensions, the two-point function of a current can contain the following contact term, which is epsilon ABC BC with an I and some appropriate normalization. And then what the T-transformation does is that it shifts this. So one thing that we didn't really explain in the paper, and also didn't explain in my talk in Stony Brook, was how do you see that these are the correct transformations? So I want to spend a few words to explain how do you see that. In other words, I want to explain why it's true that if we go to this different frame, we find this different CFT, the decoupling limit. Let's see, where should I do it? I'll do it here. So there is a very nice formula that one can use to understand this, which is the formula of the duality walls. So the idea is the following. Suppose now, without a boundary, we take a V1 gauge field. And on half space, we put some value on tau. And on the other half, we put some transformed value. For instance, let's consider the case of the S transformation. Now, since this is a duality, so these two theories have all the same set of local observables. Actually, they are completely equivalent in all senses. So this codimension one wall should be topological, meaning that we can move it around as we want. It just corresponds to implementing S-duality locally. And it turns out that in this simple case in which we just have a free theory, we can explicitly construct what this wall is. So the way to obtain this dual that changes from a tau to the S dual value of tau is just to add on this interface the following interaction. And so this is like an interaction that couples the boundary value of this to the boundary to the value of the interface of the dual field. And to convince yourself that this is the right answer, what you, the exercise that you can do to compute like the stress tensor of the theory on the two sides. And you can check that by putting this particular term on the interface, the stress tensor is going to be continuous across, which is exactly what we want for a topological wall. So why is this useful? Now, suppose I start with a fixed boundary condition. So I have my original CFT3, and I have my field A here with a certain gauge coupling tau. And I want to know what happens when I do an S transformation. How does this guy change? So I can use the following trick. I can pull one of these topological walls from infinity. And so I have here the dual gauge field. So this, again, remember, I can move it around as much as I want. And now what I'm going to do is that I'm going to collide this wall with the boundary. And so this is a boundary, remember? So what happens here? What happens is that this gauge field A is localized in this region, and in the limit becomes a 3D abelian gauge field. So its dynamics is restricted now to just 3D. And so A gets downgraded to lowercase a, which is a 3D gauge field. And and so now we're going to get the CFT3. And the current of the CFT3 is now gauged by the coupling with this small a. And now the bulk field through this term that was living on the wall, the bulk field is now coupled to what is called the topological current of the gauge theory. So this is now a gauge theory. This gauge theory has a topological current. And the topological current is precisely I over pi epsilon ABC FBC. I might have got some coefficient too wrong, but that's the idea. So that's the way we see explicitly that the S transformation does this to the theory that lives on the boundary. Is this more or less clear? Okay. So how much time do I have? Okay, so I should speed up a little bit, otherwise I will not have time for the new things. Okay, so let me just draw. So what does this construction buy us? So now we have some space of boundary conformal theories labeled by tau in the upper half plane. And so what we said is that if we go to infinity here, we have some CFT3 D1 symmetry. I should say more precisely, we get a Neumann gauge field decoupled from a particular CFT. But then I can consider other decoupling limits. So I can go here. And here I'm going to find some Neumann for the gauge field in the dual frame and decouple to another decoupled CFT, which is the U1 gauging of the original CFT3. So this notation means that we are now gauging it in 3D. And this is the decoupled sector that I find here at the origin. Yes?
Do you have a similar explanation for the T transformation?
Yes, yes. There is also for the T transformation, but it's more boring. What you do is just you have the same gauge field on both sides. You have tau here and tau plus one here, and you just have a Chern-Simons for the gauge field in the middle. So here I'm gonna find this new CFT, which is like an abelian gauging of the previous one. And I can do other things. I can also do, why not, an S T to the K. And if I do S to the K, I'm going to find the Neumann boundary condition for the new rotated gauge field. And here I will have, instead of just U1 gauging, I will have U1 level K with also K units of Chern-Simons that gauges the original CFT. Of course, you can do more complicated SL2Z, and in general, what you're going to find is some family of abelian gauge field. It's not going to be sufficient to have just one, with some complicated K matrix between them, and coupled in some way to the current of the CFT. But naively speaking, what this is telling is that all these points here on the real axis should correspond to some Chern-Simons with like real level in a sense, coupled to the original CFT. So this is a way to make these naive words precise. One thing that, I don't know how to prove in other ways, that if we assume that there is continuity in this parameter tau, one immediately draws the conclusion that the data of two theories which have very close by rationals level of Chern-Simons or even real levels should have similar conformal data. And I don't know how to derive that in some other way. So now this was a bit naive because I didn't discuss some caveat that can exist. So let me briefly discuss these caveats. there could be obstructions for the existence of this conformal theory for all values of tau. These obstructions are beta functions for boundary operators that can break the conformal symmetry. Because what I said is that tau is exactly marginal, but I mean, there is not only tau, there are also all the boundary operators, and some of them can get beta functions. So what can happen is that, first of all, if the theory here has some marginal operators, we should make sure that the beta function ordered by ordering 1 over tau can be set to 0. It is one check. But can also something more complicated can happen. What can happen is that at some point here, some curve on the tau plane, there is some operator of the theory, some scalar operator that becomes marginal. And so if this happens, we can generate a beta function for this, and this can break conformality. So this is in general like outside so the calculable regime of this theory is just around infinity, and in general there can be some strong coupling phenomena that obstructs the existence of the theory for all values of tau. Okay, I will not, since I want to go to other things, I will not say much more about this, but you can ask me later. So this is still a bit abstract, but let me mention some nice application. So one nice application that you can do, so I cannot really compute if here I put some arbitrary strongly coupled CFT with U1 symmetry, but I can simplify my life and put like a free CFT with a U1 symmetry here. And then if I put a free CFT with a U1 symmetry, I can do perturbation theory in, one over tau, and I start computing the conformal data here around infinity. Now, one can like dream to compute to very high order in tau, and then try to extrapolate here on the real axis, and get data of some abelian gauge fields, abelian gauge theories in three dimensions. This is, of course, hard because we have to do some infinite extrapolations, and there is no reason why this should work in principle. But there is some better situation. Better situation can happen thanks to the 3D dualities. So we can be in the lucky case in which actually we start with a free theory here, and when we gauge it, some of these gauge theories also accidentally turn out to be dual to some free field theory. So this means that then we have two points around which we can do perturbation theory. The prominent example of this is if we consider a Dirac fermion here. Just consider one simple Dirac fermion. And you do this construction, you find the following. Here, there is also a Dirac fermion. I'm being a bit sloppy about the fact that we need to shift tau in order to make this theory parity invariant. But let me skip these details, otherwise I will not be able to go to some other stuff. And there are actually two other interesting points in which actually we find that also using 3D dualities. So what you expect here to get in general on this line is a Dirac fermion gauged with some units of Chern-Simons. But then it actually turns out that if you sit here at tau equal 1/2 or tau equal minus 1/2, there is a 3D duality that tells you that this is precisely the O2 model. So here we now have some nice construction in which we can do perturbation theory around infinity, perturbation theory around zero, and these two things are mapped to each other, and then we can try to extrapolate to, for instance, get some data of the O2 model. And this is the example that we studied in more details in our paper. We did some true calculation, and then use some S-duality improved PADE to extrapolate here. And for instance, you can compute the energy operator, the dimension of the energy operator of the two model, starting with the anomalous dimension of psi bar psi around the Dirac fermion point. And yeah, you can play this sort of perturbative games. OK, one could say that this is just a miracle. OK, you're talking about some very special example, the Dirac fermion. OK, this is another Dirac fermion. But actually, there are also some other examples. Let me mention them. So it turns out that if there are two other nice examples that I know of, you can also consider putting, OK, I did the free fermion, so what else can I do? The free scalar. So if you put a free complex scalar here, you have some similar looking diagram. Admittedly, this is a little bit more conjectural, but still. There's supposed to be the free scalar here, also in the origin. And here we have the Gross-Neve CFT lying somewhere on the real axis. And there is also a nice example with the n equals 2 SUSY in the bulk. It's a simple generalization in which instead of having just a free gauge field, you consider the full n equals 2 supersymmetry vector multiplet. And you have a 1/2 BPS boundary condition, which you can put a free chiral here. This theory actually has, instead of having another free point here, it turns out that there are points which are also dual to a free chiral, here and here. And then there is a triality that exchanges them. So I think this would be a very nice example to study, perhaps using perturbation theory. OK, so in the last 10 minutes, I want to, so these are just some examples that I wanted to mention, but now I want to go to what we are thinking about now, which is, if we say something beyond perturbation theory, using bootstrap methods. So that's what we started exploring. Unfortunately, I will not have amazing plots results to show you, but just some preliminary considerations. Maybe by the end of the meeting, who knows? Okay, so can we go beyond perturbation theory using bootstrap techniques? So a possible strategy that one can think of would be to look at the four-point functions of these operators I and J that I mentioned, that are like the boundary values. And okay, this seems hard, but there are two things that I want to mention. One is that one can use the equations of motion in the bulk to derive relations between OP coefficients of like J, J, with some other arbitrary boundary operators, lambda I, and the same boundary operator, lambda I, J, O. Let's say that these three coefficients, one can use the equations of motion in the bulk to actually see that basically they reduce to one coefficient. Okay. And on top of that, the equations of motion also entail the existence of a lot of protected operators on the boundary, coming from basically the higher spin currents in the bulk. So, of course, these are the constraints that one should try to play with. And the other thing that one can play with is the one should certainly, in this problem, try to impose a gap on delta t, which is a gap in the spin 2, because the theory is non-local. There is an important, so in this case, if one tries to solve this problem with the bootstrap, one is really trying to bootstrap some conformal manifold. So there is a crucial point that one should try to understand, which is how to see tau in the conformal data. And this actually seems to be a bit hard. The reason being that usually to see the gauge coupling, you would need to have some operator that's charged under the symmetry, because this is really what is sensitive to the normalization of the currents. But charged operators in this setup only can appear as like endpoints of bulk lines, so they're not really local operators. So if you restrict yourself to just correlators of local operators, you're not really gonna see explicitly this parameter tau. Okay, so this is like a dream, but now we took a step back and we said, okay, but why don't we consider first the simpler setup of just the free bulk scalar field? So let me go back to that. So first, try the free scalar. So in this case, the analog of this current, 3D current operators, is played by these two scalar operators, which are phi hat and dy phi hat. And so the problem that we wanted to study there gets mapped in this case to like trying to like carve out the space of possible interacting boundary conditions for a free scalar by studying the four-point functions of these two guys. These two guys have protected dimension. If the bulk is dimension D, this is always of dimension D over 2 minus 1, and this is always of dimension D over 2. And so let me, in this example, I can explain a little bit better what are these relations. So how do we derive these relations? One does the following. Okay, we just look at this, take two-point function, phi, phi, and you put an operator O here. This can be done for generic spin operator. And then you just impose the familiar two-point function. Sorry, this is actually not a two-point. It's a two in the bulk, one in the boundary. But OK, this correlation function admits two OP channels, which is this and this. And the magic is that you can explicitly resum this because it's very simple, the back to one derivative of P. And then once you get a closed form expression for this three-point function, you impose that the correct singularity in the bulk of P is reproduced, which of course you have perfectly under control because this is just a free theory. And you get some nice relations between, okay, maybe I should conclude with these relations. You get some nice non-trivial relations between, let me just write this. Let me call O1 phi hat and O2 dy phi hat. There is some coefficient here which depend on the dimension, the spin, the dimension of space-time. So this you can prove in general. Where the coefficients bi are just the coefficients of the two-point function between phi and y. And they're actually both determined in terms of one single coefficient, which is the one-point function of phi square in the bulk. So one gets all these exact relations, and the hope is that this can be used to constrain like the bootstrap problem for this, for the four-point function of these guys. Okay, I think I don't have much time, but just let me mention a few more things. So one thing is that, so Edo did a lot of work and used these constraints and derived this nice relation with new coefficients. And then at a certain point, we realized that exactly the same things were derived in the nice paper by Connor about the long-range easing bootstrap. And of course, the reason why the same relations exist there is because the two setups are some sort of related to each other. We know that the long-range easing can be realized as some higher codimension defect. And ultimately, it comes from the fact that in some sense, these two operators are the shadow transform of each other. In some sense, it can be made more precise. So we then started talking to Connor, and we saw that many of his results for the long-range easing immediately bear some consequences also for this problem. Should I say something more? So yeah, so the hope for the future is that, okay, we want to try to make progress in this using these constraints, and there are various numerical investigations that we started, but of course it's all very preliminary, but I'm happy to tell you offline about what we're doing. Okay, I think I should conclude, I'm out of time.
Okay, I have a question about, can you hear me? Okay, I have a question about the SL2Z duality of the U1 3D gauge theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking about the possible the non-abelian generation of this duality.
Sorry, I didn't hear, can you repeat?
Okay, so I'm thinking about the non-abelian generation of this SL2Z duality.
Which regime?
Non-abelian. I mean, generalize this as a...
Non-abelian, what is non-abelian?
Of the SL2Z duality, of the...
Ah,
So, but there's a problem that, of course, for the SL2D duality, we have two operations. One is the strong weak S operation, another one is T operation.
Yes.
But for T operation, of course, we can make it, make it for the EML schedule failure theory as well. Mm-hmm. But for the S operation, it's kind of confusing that because for the Abelian case, you always have a topological U1 Galois symmetry, and then you can gauge this symmetry.
Yes.
Therefore, you can fulfill the S trend operation. But in the non-Abelian case, do you have any idea about how to realize the possible S2 operation of this?
Okay, I'm not sure I fully understood. Are you talking about non-Abelian gauge fields or not? Or are you talking about...
For the U1 gauge field theory, we have the SL2Z duality, right?
Okay, if the question is about non-Abelian gauge fields, so there is a big problem like at step zero, which is that the theory is not conformal in the bulk. So...
No, I'm not talking about the bulk or boundary case. I'm just the general 3D gauge theory.
Uh-huh.
Because the SL2Z duality also appears just in 3D, 3D Abelian gauge field theory, right? As we suggested.
I mean, I think the best thing one can do to try to realize non-Abelian gauge theories on the in three dimensions.
Yeah.
I think maybe the natural thing to do would be to, since the theory is now not conformal in the bulk, you could try to instead study this theory in ADS background.
Okay.
And so maybe in ADS background you can play with the parameter, like I said, the confinement scale compared to the ADS scale. Maybe there is some regime in which the theory is weakly coupled and you can still see some duality acting on the boundary conditions and try to make contact with the duality in the non-Abelian gauge theories in three dimensions. But I'm not sure. Yeah. That would be like my best attempt at generalizing this to that case.
Thanks. Okay, I have one more question.
Yes.
So for I'm not quite sure about the more details about your bootstrap proposal for the. So I mean, is there SL2Z duality placement zero in your bootstrap setup? Can you explain it in more details?
So you're asking if there is some duality also in the.
Yeah, I mean, did you employ this SL2Z duality in your bootstrap setup?
Ah, yeah, I see. In this this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right, so let's remember that the SL2Z generically does not remain like a symmetry when I have boundary,
it's just
right?
Operation,
because
actually.
It transforms the boundary data. Now, there are special cases like the one in which you have the Dirac fermion both at infinity and in the origin, in which some subset of SL2Z actually does map the boundary data back to itself. Okay? Mm. So, and in that case, what that basically means is that you're going to have some fixed point of this involution in the conformal manifold in which this is going to become a global symmetry. So what you can try to do is that maybe you can try to start to try to bootstrap that particular point in which you have some additional Z2 global symmetry. So that could be something interesting to try, maybe.
Okay, thanks.
Any other question? If not, let's thank Lorenzo and go.